Welcome to another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. When you think photojournalism, what comes to mind? Civil war, global geopolitical conflicts, humanitarian crises. Photojournalism uses images to tell a news story while adhering to a rigid ethical standard, which demands that the work be honest and impartial while telling a story. Those images must present a fair and accurate representation of events they're documenting in both content and tone. Well, you're about to meet an internationally acclaimed photojournalist who is known for her groundbreaking documentation not of civil war, global or geopolitical conflicts, or humanitarian crises, but the hidden world of domestic violence. When Donna Ferrato's book, Living with the Enemy, was published in 1991, it not only went into four printings, it launched a national discussion about women's rights and sexual violence. In 2011, her I Am Unbeatable campaign began. Its goal? To expose, document, and try to prevent domestic violence against women and children through real stories about real people. She continues to publish new work on women's rights. Donna's work has appeared in nearly every major news publication in this country, and her photographs have been part of nearly 500 solo exhibitions in museums and galleries all over the world. She's a recipient of the W. Eugene Smith Grant, the Robert F. Kennedy Award for Outstanding Coverage of the Plight of the Disadvantaged, the IWMF Courage in Journalism Award, the Missouri Medal of Honor for Distinguished Service in Journalism, Artist of the Year at the Tribeca Film Festival. In 2008, the city of New York proclaimed October 30th Donna Ferrato Appreciation Day. And a year later, she was recognized by New York Supreme Court judges for her work advancing gender equality. Her most recent project focuses on the spirit and evolution of Manhattan's Tribeca neighborhood. Donna, welcome, and thanks for joining me today.
Thank you.
So you and photojournalism, how did that relationship come to be?
Well, it started back in 1980 when I met my longtime partner and the father of my daughter, Fanny, Philip Jones Griffiths, a Magnum photographer, a war photographer, at the Republican National Convention here in New York City in 1980. I have to say, before I met him, I never thought about photojournalism. I was a street photographer.
You studied photography?
I didn't really study photography. Briefly at the San Francisco Art Institute, I studied sociology and photography, but the streets were my teacher. And then along the way, I would meet people like Philip Jones Griffiths, who showed me a way to really contain the message through a photograph. And he showed me how to make sense of my feelings through photographs. He was a massive influence on me. He was such a strong advocate for the documentary style of photography, which is to really be quiet, be like a little mouse, and watch what's going on and try to capture things as they're happening, as it makes sense to you.
Not being intrusive.
Not being
invisible.
Intrusive. Being invisible. Not being judgmental as well. That was a really important quality for me too, because I have strong opinions, and I had to learn how to not be judgmental and simply be there. Be there and show what's happening in front of my eyes. This work, actually, in the book Living with the Enemy, began while I was with Philip. We never married. We lived together. We had the child, Fanny, while I was doing this work. In fact,
how old were you?
I was 32 at the time when I had her. And so I started this work on violence against women when Fanny was in my womb. And she was giving me that power as a woman to really see things and say something with my camera. She made me into a fierce warrior.
Wow.
Even before she was born, she did that.
There was something very empowering to you about being pregnant and bringing a
absolutely.
Life into the world.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Not in a, I didn't think about it
That overtly?
Overtly, exactly. But it just, happened. You know, I gave birth to her at home. No mm-hmm. doctors. And Philip was very
And no
much
midwife
like that.
Either?
We had a midwife,
okay.
yeah.
All right. So that's not completely alone.
No, no, no.
And that's not in a rice paddy.
No. It would have been great in a rice paddy.
I'm not so sure. So something changed within you during your pregnancy and
yes.
the subsequent birth. Was there also a vulnerability as a woman that might have attracted you to this subject too?
I don't know about that, Sandy. The vulnerability, I wasn't really, I've never considered myself so vulnerable.
So give us this genesis of this connection that you had with this hideous problem of domestic violence.
I was a pretty happy-go-lucky young woman back in the 70s.
Where'd you grow up?
Grew up in Ohio. Lorain, Ohio. I went to Laurel School for Girls, which was a very non-denominational, but very focused on academics and on girls being leaders. And this was probably where my sense of being a strong female began to form.
Not so much at home, huh?
Well, at home, my mom was strong. My dad was he really believed in me. But my mom was very tough on me. She didn't believe in me very much, and we fought quite a bit. So I wasn't being encouraged to be whoever I wanted to be. I was always being told I was going to be a bag lady. So I have to say I wasn't really learning about personal female power in my home. Even though my mom was a really hard worker, She taught me the ethics of working, but she really didn't understand what I was searching for as a young woman. I think, though, because my relationship with her was so rocky in the house.
And fraught.
And fraught with constant, you know, battling and it was a good thing I was sent away at the age of 12. I didn't live at home from the age of 12.
Oh, so the school was a boarding school. Okay.
Not for everybody, but for about 30 of us, I'd say. And I didn't have to worry about being right or wrong.
Or pleasing her.
Pleasing her, exactly. I could create these friendships that became very solid with the girls, like in my dorm. I learned how to fight for bigger things. Like I was always fighting in school for student rights. And it was great to be able to do that. And playing soccer and playing hockey and basketball, not being a cheerleader for the boys, but playing sports, this was our way to express ourselves and to know who we were and to figure out the rules and aims of the game. And so that was a terrific thing, actually, to be with all girls for 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
Then I went to college in an all-girls school for 2 years. And then I just wanted to get out in the world. It was kind of a crazy world. When I went to college in 1968, I was graduating from high school.
Me too. We're contemporaries.
So mm-hmm. I was graduating from high school on the day that Robert F. Kennedy was killed.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was going out into the world, I hated society. I hated that world that we were inheriting, supposedly, and trying to figure out what to make of it. I didn't want to wear a bra. I didn't want to wear stockings. I wanted to wear jeans. Didn't want to go to school. I was a rebel, you know, and all my causes seemed fair enough. I was fighting against the war. I wasn't involved so much with the civil rights movement, although I totally supported it. But I wasn't going down south. I was more about women's rights.
Got it.
And so that's basically how I kind of went along. I got married, realized after getting married to my true love that when he became a lawyer, I didn't want to be a lawyer's wife either.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to be a wife.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't want to do any of those things. I loved him, but I didn't want to be a wife. I didn't want to have his profession deciding my life.
Become your identity.
Exactly. So I broke away from him. I just kept breaking away and going off on the road, hitchhiking, doing whatever I could just to figure out why I was here as a woman. And it wasn't until I went over to Europe, bounced around there, always photographing, never knowing where my next meal was coming from. This went for 2 years.
But you went places with a camera. You knew you had to do that.
Exactly.
Okay.
The camera
was
my passport.
And that was a natural act for you. Got it.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I didn't learn that in school. Nobody taught that to me. Mm-hmm. I didn't have any friends who were photographers. I really didn't know anybody else who was a photographer, except my dad. Mm-hmm. My dad showed me the way to be a photographer because he was always photographing the ordinary life, mm-hmm. family life, neighborhood life, his life as a hunter, as a doctor. That was his hobby and his passion. And it became my hobby, my passion, and then it became my profession.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is photojournalist Donna Ferrato. Okay, so you and your camera go traipsing all over the place, and then you meet Philip. Before he entered your life, were you earning a living?
Well, I would say I was earning a little bit of a living. I was kind of smart about that. Before I came back to New York, I would take my pictures around to people in Europe, and I would sell them, the portraits to the people in the marketplace. I would use them to buy food, whatever, to exchange. I was bartering my photographs.
Wow.
Back in the early days.
Uh-huh. And that sustained you, huh?
And that sustained me, yeah. And I was living off the kindness of friends. People would let me into the house, say, will you take care of my kids and will you can have a bed and food? I didn't know any other way. When I was living in San Francisco, actually, I did work at the Hilton Hotel taking pictures with a big speed graphic camera of tourists. So I'd take their pictures and I get paid for these pictures.
By the tourists themselves?
No, by the company that hired me to shoot these pictures. So this was a real little business.
Got it.
That was kind of how I operated. I was never proud about trying to make money mm-hmm. with a picture. I didn't think of myself as an artist in any way. I was a worker. And when I came to New York City, I started to take my little box of prints around to some of the photo directors. And one man at People magazine, he was the head of People magazine, he started to yell at me. And I said, what do you think I should give you a job for with these kinds of pictures? They were all my pictures of old Belgian men and people in cafes in Paris. And he said, I have the finest photographers in the business who depend on me for jobs. I pay their bills. I send them around the world. And
who the hell do you think you are?
Yeah, who the hell do you think you are? You don't even know how to use filters, do you? Mm-hmm. And I looked at him and, I felt like crying, but I didn't. And I kind of bit my lip and I looked at him very fiercely and I said, well, you know what? Maybe I can show you something with my camera that all those men can't show you with their big cameras and lenses.
Love your balls. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I said to him this thing, and he stopped, and he grew silent, and he looked at me. His name was John Dominus, a great, great Life magazine photographer who'd become the photo director at People. And he said, I'm sorry, Donna. I think it's just I had some dental surgery, and I'm sorry to be so mean to you. Would you like to photograph my daughter's wedding? And so it began. I got my foot in the door, and he started to give me a little
job. And you proved yourself to him.
Exactly, mm-hmm. exactly. And that's how it went for me, very slowly.
Okay, so now take us.
So then I'm there with, I'm getting assignments from the Soho Weekly News. Mm-hmm. And New York Magazine actually sent me right into Plato's Retreat to get a picture of a guy who was the owner of Plato's Retreat.
Explain what that is for people who don't know.
Plato's Retreat back in 1979 was a phenomenon. It was a human experiment for married couples. It was a place where married couples could go, a club. Actually, Bette Midler made it famous there, the bathhouse, which was, mm-hmm. Most of the time it was for gay excitement and fun and pleasure and craziness. But once a night, every week, it was for heteros to go in and go crazy, too.
Sexually crazy.
Swinging. It was called swinging.
Mm, yep,
oh,
yep.
My God. Big, bad swingers.
And they asked you to photograph?
And they asked me to photograph. On the
hetero night?
Yeah, on the hetero night, to get a picture of Larry Levinson and his wife sitting on, he was going to be sitting on the throne. And this is my big chance. And
who was Larry Levinson?
Larry Levinson was the owner of Plato's
oh, okay.
Retreat.
Mm-hmm.
So I went in there, and I was really shocked at the things that I was seeing. They had the mat room, which was where all these couples would just throw themselves in a room with a bunch of pillows and all just mix and match it all up. Then there were all the private rooms, you know, where you could close a door, go in and close a door. Then there was the disco floor that was very much like Saturday Night Fever, you know, where you saw the smoke coming up and the multicolored tiles on the floors. It was craziness. And I had to figure out how to get in there, get a picture of this guy, Larry Levinson, and get out without being touched. I didn't want anybody to even look at me. I was a little scared in this place, you know, big swimming pool. Where everybody was jumping in naked. And it was just total, it was like a Hieronymus Bosch painting.
Got it.
So I got my picture of Larry Levinson. And even though he invited me to stay a while, I said, no, thank you very much.
That's all right, I don't do threesomes, but thanks a lot.
I didn't do anything, although I was very curious about it. But I was scared. I guess in that moment, I felt vulnerable. And
that's when you really wanted to be an invisible photographer, right?
Oh, God, really, really. That's where I started to think about being invisible. But instead, I ran home. It was a winter night, very cold and snowy. Went home, developed the film in the lab where I was living in our little house. It was this bunch of photographers living there on Fifth Avenue and 18th Street. But somebody had put the fixer into the developer. And so when I developed the film, the rolls came out blank.
Ay, ay, ay.
Oh, my God. I couldn't let my first assignment go down the toilet like that. So I went dashing out. It was like 2 o'clock in the morning. Went dashing back uptown to 79th Street and said to Larry Levinson, please, sir, could you sit on the throne again with your wife? And, yes, he was very nice. But he was like the big bad wolf leering at me. And I got my pictures, and so then he said, look at little girl, you know, why don't you just relax a little bit? Go swimming in the pool here, relax a little bit. So I did that. I took my clothes off, and I put my camera with a towel, and I dove into the pool. There was nobody in the pool at the time. And the rest was history. From that point on, I started to see what was going on, and it really enticed me, seeing people like this with just abandoning all their sexual mores and hang-ups and inhibitions to the smoke on the floor and the pillows in the mat room.
But that must be in just such sharp contrast to living with the enemy.
I know.
So
we
got to talk about it.
This is where I met Lisa and Bengt. I met them in Plato's Retreat. And Lisa at the time was pretty much just like me, except that she was a beautiful, sophisticated young woman. Her
An
husband,
employee or a
no,
patron?
No, a patron. They were the wealthiest patrons that ever walked through the door of Plato's Retreat. And I looked at them and I thought that they were like a god and a goddess, as everybody did. And, you know, they weren't doing the things like all the other couples were, but I thought that they were she was a beautiful woman with a lot of dignity and class, and he seemed to adore her. And so, every so often, I got to the point where I could talk to people.
So you kept going back.
I kept going back, and I would go back on nights when it was okay to photograph everybody, and I would get to talk to people. And so with this couple, Lisa and her husband, I said to them, you know, sometime I would really like to go home with you, and I would like to photograph you at home because, you know, I'm a girl of the 60s. I want to see people who love each other. That's what I was interested in. Love, no jealousy, no violence, no abuse. Just give me that, pure love. And so they offered that to me. They invited me to their home.
And you didn't know what you were necessarily going to do with these photographs that you wanted
no,
to shoot.
No, I just knew this was what I had no assignment. I had
okay.
nothing.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to photograph beautiful, happy people. That's all I knew in love.
Okay.
Because I had failed at my marriage. I wanted to see how do you make a marriage last?
Mm-hmm.
How do you build a good relationship with your spouse? So I thought Lisa and Garth were... his real name was Banked, but I call him Garth in the book. I thought that they were going to introduce me to this way to keep a marriage alive and working in a positive way. I never expected to see what happened with this family. But that's what introduced me to domestic violence, being in their home. And in the beginning, everything was fine. And I was pregnant, remember, at the time. I had gotten pregnant, so I was doing this story. Philip was encouraging me to do it my way. In those days, nobody had ever done any stories about swinging. Most of my friends who are photographers looked down on me, and they said, why are you even doing this? These people are disgusting, Donna. Everybody was so judgmental about swingers. And I didn't care. I wasn't going to judge them. I wanted to learn from them. But as the time went by, visiting their house, their big fancy mansion out in Saddle River, New Jersey, I saw that there were cracks in this facade of the happy swinging couple and who were raising. They had already her two daughters from another marriage, and they had three sons together. And I started to see cracks in the facade. And then I started to feel that I didn't admire these people for what was going on in their house, and I pulled away. During the period that I separated from them, I had my daughter. And it was after this that I got a call from the wife, and she was very nervous, and she asked me to come back out and see them. And she said she thought her husband was changing. So I went out with my daughter, and that's when I really saw the monster that this man had become. The violence occurred on that night that I returned
physical
to the house.
And physical, verbal?
Verbal and physical.
So
and
he was beating her in front of you?
That's when it began, yes.
And obviously you were invisible to him, or he just didn't
he
give
didn't
a damn.
Care. He didn't give care. A damn. Now, many people have always asked me this. Oh, are you sure he wasn't just doing this because
for
you were
show.
There, Donna, to show off to you? Why wouldn't he care that you were there? And, you know, since then, I've photographed for over 10 years, about 3 months out of every year for 10 years to do my book, Living with the Enemy. I've ridden with the cops, you know, more than 1,000 hours all over the country. I've lived
responding to domestic violence calls, you mean?
With the cops.
Yes, I understand.
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
Then I've lived in the emergency rooms waiting for couples to come in or for the woman to be brought in close to death. Then I have to talk always with the families to be able to get permission to photograph whatever is going to happen in that emergency room and afterwards. I live in the shelters. I've lived in prisons with women who've killed their abusers. So I've learned by doing it, by being there, that when a man wants to beat his wife, he will do it in front of the children. He will do it in front of her family, her parents. He will do it in front of their neighbors. He will do it in front of the cops. He will do it in the middle of the street. He will do it in a store. When a man wants to beat his wife, he believes that he has the right to
mm-hmm.
do this.
Mm-hmm.
He believes that he is doing something that will teach her a lesson.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And all of these men, even men who aren't paying the bills, even men who are living off of a woman because she pays the bills, because she's out there working every day, somehow they feel so entitled to push this message through that if you don't obey me, I will punish you. I will hurt you so bad. Whether I break you down or whether I break your children down, I am the master of this house.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is photojournalist Donna Ferrato. This had to have blown you away.
It blew my mind because I didn't grow up like this. I didn't grow up. My father was not like this. I never saw any kind of behavior like this
and
in
then,
my life.
And then you knew that you had to do something with this.
Yes.
Something larger.
Yes.
And is that how the book was born?
Yes, because listen, Sandy, when I first started to really get serious about this subject back in 1980, and then, you know, I started to photograph it, and then I started to look for magazines who would publish it. They pushed me away.
No kidding.
They weren't interested in this. Also, I wasn't photographing black people who are living in poor communities where they have no rights. Many photographers will go out, white photographers will go into poor black communities and document drug addictions or violence or abuse or whatever. And they'll, you know, half the time they don't even get releases. I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to take advantage of people who don't know that they have power. I wanted to get into those white communities, and I was amazed that I was able to do this. Actually, the first person that I photographed was a man. He was a millionaire, and he was living right next door to Richard Nixon. So I wanted to...
The Plato's people.
And swingers. Let me tell you, Sandy, swingers are not poor people. To be a swinger...
Costs a lot of money.
Costs a lot of money. Mm-hmm. These are people who pay a lot of taxes. They have multiple homes. They have boats. They have planes. Mm-hmm. They can go anywhere. Many of these people are like the press, you know, guys who run the GOP. These are the guys who are the big swingers, you know, a lot of them. And they go to church on Sunday and all that sort of stuff. But you know, from that point on, I was staying away from swinging and really focusing on domestic violence because I saw that the magazine editors were not, they didn't want to do stories like this. They were afraid of it. Or if they assigned me, if they said to me, okay, Donna, you can go live in a shelter if you think that's important, because I'd already photographed the violence. So some of these editors at Life magazine, they wanted to give me a chance to see what else I could do. But even though they would give me money to go out in the world and take pictures, they wouldn't publish them. And my book, this book, Living with the Enemy, was already halfway done in 1986 when I applied for the Eugene Smith Grant, and I got it. When I got the Eugene Smith Grant, suddenly I had credibility. And suddenly the magazines like Life magazine had to take me more seriously. And then the Philadelphia Inquirer Sunday magazine, they were fantastic because they said, we want to publish some of these pictures. But I would say to them, no, you can't publish anything that I've done already. If you are interested in this work, you have to take a chance. You have to risk something of yourself and send me out into the field. And I want to photograph domestic violence in Philadelphia. So pay me whatever you want, and I'm going to work as long as I need to. They paid me $3,000. I was a young mother. I had a 4-year-old daughter. $3,000 lasted for 9 months for me. I kept going back and forth, working on domestic violence stories in Philadelphia. And they were so like stunned by these pictures that they were the first to publish any of my work on domestic violence. The picture of the woman Ruth on the cover of Living with the Enemy, she's a Philadelphia woman. And that was the cover, the first cover for the Philadelphia Inquirer Sunday magazine. That was the first time that people in the United States woke up one morning and they got a look at a real battered woman on their Sunday morning magazine with two black eyes and a broken nose. And they were able to read her real story. Nothing phony baloney.
This whole compilation, this work, just sort of just took on a life of its own.
Yeah.
And
it kept compelling me, Sandy.
It was a drug. You couldn't you couldn't quit it.
I couldn't quit it. It's still a drug. But like, you know, also what sort of made me happy, my reward was to hear what men had to say about these pictures. Like the very first big time photo director and one of the men, the most powerful men at Life magazine, his name is John Lowengard. What he said when he first saw these pictures of Lisa being beaten in her bathroom, he said, "You got it." And that's why he decided to invest in me.
You've been to war.
Basically, yeah. And I go into war where there are no other photographers and there's nobody backing me up. Mm-hmm. There's no, you know, army on either side. It's just me and a man and a woman and these poor little frightened kids.
And nobody took a punch at you.
Well, you know, they threw one guy threw me down. Lisa's husband threw me down. But no, nobody took a punch at me. I don't know why. But what was very I love what my father said to me early on when these pictures started to be published in magazines like Life magazine, the Philadelphia Inquirer. He said, "I'm proud of what you're doing, but I have to tell you, you made it really hard for men to get away with beating up their wives."
Oh, what a shame. Oh, I'm so sorry.
And then another photographer, a male, Tony Sois, who was my, you know, friend back in those days, you know, when the pictures were starting to be published in places, and he came up to me and he said, you know, Donna, your pictures make it me feel really, really bad to be a man. And I kept getting this from men. One man wrote in a book where my pictures are being exhibited, this photographer has finally proven that there are places where photographers should not be allowed to go. You know, I was really getting under their skin.
Gee, what a surprise.
But it was, but the biggest criticism was coming from feminists. In the early days, they would follow me from exhibition to exhibition. There would be a flank of them watching because they were angry with me.
Were you sabotaging women in their eyes?
In their eyes, because I was showing women at the lowest point in their lives.
Yeah,
and they thought that I was getting off on this, like, you know.
At their expense.
At the women's expense. They didn't really understand. These women were signing releases to be, I was telling their story accurately. And they didn't understand also that I was getting men's stories too. I was showing the pictures of the men who beat women. I'm not just showing pictures of women at the lowest point in their lives. And I'm showing women who go to prison for killing their abusers. All of these things were leading up to my most important work that I've been involved with since for more than 10 years, which is I Am Unbeatable. You know, as I kept looking at the pictures of the women in my book, I realized that all of these women, they didn't go back. Ruth didn't go back to her abuser. I would say 90% of the women in my book, they didn't go back. But the story that I was always reading in the press was why I stayed, why I stayed. So it was almost like giving women, you know, the right to keep talking about why I stayed instead of saying, no, I left because it got so bad that I knew I was going to die. And for the women who did go back, oftentimes they did end up dead or they did end up having to kill their abuser, and then they go to prison for 30 years, not the men.
Right.
They always get off. All they do is plead guilty, and they get off. I have to be there on the front lines, walking in the women's shoes, walking in the kids' shoes, walking with the cops.
You're a crusader, a very talented woman on a mission with a passion.
No, I'm not done yet.
So can you briefly just say what's on the horizon for you?
I think that women's reproductive rights is probably the most important fight. I'm ready for it.
So you've got something up your sleeve.
I did a story last summer for Mother Jones on abortion issues and how so many of these centers are being shut down, especially in the South. I'm sickened by it. You know, this is what we fought for back in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s. To be going now to a place where women are actually aborting because they have no abortion centers. Women are having to abort their, and you know, in the bathtubs.
Yep.
They're waking up after they've been hemorrhaging and finding themselves in handcuffs.
Yes, it's 2016, everybody.
This is 2016. This is it. We are back in the caves. So, you know.
So it's another political issue for you. It's critical.
It's a big one.
But it's in real contrast to taking photographs of your neighborhood of Tribeca.
That's what keeps me sane.
Yeah, I would think so.
It inspires me.
I would think so.
But I'm ready to move on from that, too.
Well, Donna, it's been nothing short of wonderful to have gotten to know you and to listen to your story. You are an amazing woman. I feel very empowered by you. Don't stop. You know?
I love you, Sandy.
Oh,
really.
That's so nice. Thank you so much for joining me today. Join us for another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. And if you have someone you would like to see interviewed or hear interviewed, please contact us at sandyclineshow.com.